Would you like to study the Bible, but don't really know where to start? Bob Enyart's seminar on hermeneutics, tools for studying the Bible, will help you to study and understand the Bible on a whole new level. Hermeneutics, tools for studying the Bible, is available by calling 1-800-8-ENYART, or you can get the MP3 CD or the MP3 download at kgovstore.com. That's kgovstore.com. Hey, science fans, now you can have all of the Real Science Friday shows on MP3 CD from 2007, 2008, or 2009. Hear Bob and Fred present the compelling scientific evidence that the Earth is young and that there is a creator. Real Science Friday 2007, 2008, and 2009 are each available by calling 1-800-8-ENYART. Or you can get the MP3 CDs or the MP3 downloads at kgovstore.com.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
Fred, there is a great edition of Creation Magazine out. This is the April to June 2011 edition, and there is fun science in this magazine.
Lots of great articles.
The first one I'd like to do, could I pick first?
You can pick first. Go ahead, Bob.
Thanks. Archaeopteryx.
Archaeopteryx.
Because this one, the evolutionists say, textbooks say, National Geographic said that Archaeopteryx is a transitional form between reptiles and birds. And in this article that's put out by Creation.com, Creation Ministries International, and I know evolutionists listening right now, they'll say, well, you can't believe anything a creationist says. Well, consider this. Consider. They say, even though Archaeopteryx is claimed by textbooks to be a transitional form between reptiles and birds, they say the truth is that Archaeopteryx had fully formed flight feathers. It had wings. Its wings were attached to a large wishbone, which is necessary for the muscles the way they work. And it had a perching foot, bird-like bones, and a bird-like brain case.
Sounds like you just described a bird.
Sounds like a bird to me, Fred.
If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, is a duck a bird?
Yeah. So, Fred, what do you think about this? I know there are evolutionists listening who will say, well, anything a creationist says, they believe that it's false. And that's unfortunate because I read what evolutionists say and I weigh their evidence.
Well, so do I. You know, it's interesting. This is one of those cases where we have a leading evolutionist expert on birds who himself does believe in evolution. But this is what he said about this bird. And now this guy, his name is Dr. Alan Fiducia, and he's a professor of avian evolution, and he's a world authority on birds. He's from the University of North Carolina. That's where he teaches.
Yeah, he is the bird man.
He's the bird man.
He's the real bird man. And his specialty is avian evolution. That's his thing.
It's his specialty. And he wrote an article, and it was aptly titled, Bird Catches a Can of Worms. Well, what does he mean by that? Well, he was talking about Archaeopteryx, and he said that paleontologists have tried to turn Archaeopteryx into an earthbound feathered dinosaur. But it's not. It's a bird. It's a perching bird. And no amount of paleo babble is going to change that.
Whoa, that was J. Allen Fiducia?
Yes, that was Dr. Fiducia,
wow.
An evolutionist bird expert.
And that is fiducial responsibility right
That's
there.
That's right.
What a perfect example. Fred, evolutionists criticize creationists for quote mining. They call it quote mining. And no kidding. I mean, leading evolutionists have created this rich mine, this vein of gold nuggets everywhere you turn. So, of course, we're going to repeat to the world the quotes from many of their leading experts that they'd rather pretend never were said or are not true.
That's right. And, you know, if this is such convincing evidence as a transitional form, why is it so easy to find evolutionists themselves? In this case, he's an expert on birds, and he doesn't buy into the dinosaur-to-bird link.
Right. And then, Fred, something else. You know how we've been talking about soft tissue that's been discovered in dinosaurs? And this is happening at major universities around the country. Now, Harvard's gotten into the game. They sequenced some hadrosaur proteins.
Yeah, we find more and more every day, this seems like.
Well, it seems like that's if you count the creationist claims, but the secular world doesn't. So looking only at the soft tissue found by evolutionists, we've got in dinosaurs, we've got a T-Rex and a duck-billed dinosaur, a hadrosaur. And so the guys with an Archaeopteryx fossil, Fred, they thought, well, we'd like to get in on this game. Now, these other dinosaurs, they're only 65 million and 80 million years old. Ours is 150 million years old. So they looked, and lo and behold, they found original biological material in the bones and in the feathers of their Archaeopteryx fossil. And Fred, this has been published now by the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in the U.S. Is that a creation publication?
Yeah, I don't think so, Bob.
No, I guess not. It's a motherload of evolutionary claims.
They thought this is 150 million years old?
150 million years old.
And it's the original biological material.
Yeah, and Fred, just with the random movements at the atomic level, complex molecules break down. That's why you need DNA functioning to constantly build and maintain living structures. They break down over time. And so to have this, an Archaeopteryx fossil, show that it has original biological material, I mean, the mountain of evidence against Darwinism in an old earth just keeps growing.
It just keeps growing. There's no way.
It's in the troposphere. Yeah.
There's no way this is millions of years old, and 150 million years at that. Do you see the picture in the magazine of this, an Archaeoraptor?
Right. That's from a National Geographic.
National Geographic. Well, typical that, unfortunately, you see this a lot. Here's an artist rendering. How accurate is this?
How accurate is it? Well, with all the latest research on Archaeoraptor, every detail in the drawing was false.
Every detail, okay.
Yeah. So this is not surprising. One of the world's leading experts on bird evolution says Archaeopteryx was a bird. He says, look, evolutionists, get over it. It's a bird.
That's right. So, Bob?
Yeah.
Can I interrupt the show just for a moment? I have an article here from the Denver Post.
You gave me a copy.
Yeah, I did.
Now, the Denver Post is not known to be a creationist outlet.
It's not.
No.
In fact, they're talking about a bovine, right? Or wait, what's a bovine?
A bovine? You mean like the bison?
The bison.
Denver, okay. The city of Denver owns a herd of bison.
You'll see them if you drive up to the mountains. I think everybody knows where they're at.
Off of I-70, yep. Heading west into the foothills of the Rocky Mountains on the north side of the interstate, there's a herd of bison.
And there's quite a few of them.
Yeah, and they're looking more bison-like over time.
Bison. So what's the difference between a bison and a buffalo?
Bison and a buffalo. Is this a quiz? Is there a problem? A bison is a buffalo.
Okay.
Now, I know there's those weird-looking African buffaloes.
Yeah, they have those really big horns.
Right. But a bison is what we call a buffalo.
Okay.
Right?
It's
part of
that.
The hoofed animals.
Okay.
So the Denver Post writes about these bison because bison had been bred with cattle many moons ago. And what's happening as this bison herd is reproducing, they are beginning to express their bison genes. So within not over millions of years, but within generations, their bison behavior and looks and the humpback is coming back. Because cattle, they have a flat back.
Yep.
Right? Like a Jersey cow. But the bison have humpbacks. That's all that's coming back.
So what's the title of the article? It's what drew my attention to it.
It's Denver Bison Herd Evolving Back to Ancestry.
Evolving Back to Ancestry.
Gaining Value. So whether you go forward or backward, it's an evolutionary gain.
Yeah, so you're de-evolving, but you're gaining value.
Isn't it absurd for them to say evolving? Because the Darwinian mechanism is by random mutation, and things take thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of years, not a handful of generations. So we see a lot of designed response to environmental challenges and genetic challenges that happen rapidly. And because they happen rapidly, we know that they're designed.
Yeah. So how long ago do we go back? Maybe 80 years? Mm. There's no way that a random mutation over however many generations that is, let's just say it's 10, that, you know, all these animals in the herd retain this because one of them just happened to go back,
right.
Evolve something. Because remember, evolution involves a random
mutation,
a mistake
that has to somehow be selected, even though the vast majority of mutations, even good ones, would be irrelevant. Like a fish that lays 1,000 eggs and one of them is a gem. Well, they just all get eaten anyway. 900 of them get eaten in the first 1 minute of life.
That's right.
So what's the difference if you happen to be born with one of those? I mean, the math of it is just so...
So the fact that a trait all of a sudden shows up that's not really that far back into the past is really a really good sign of complex design. It's amazing to me that this happens.
That the genome designed is robust.
Exactly. It's very robust and has so much redundancy built in. That we do see examples of natural selection reducing information, but God has designed this latent behavior in our genome to retain that to be expressed in the future when the environment necessitates it.
That is just awesome. And Fred, one example that's in this article is the way the bison react when a coyote comes by or when one of the bison, one of these buffalo, gets injured.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting. So, you know, if a bison rubs against a fence, a barbed wire fence, and hurts itself and starts to bleed, he kind of makes himself susceptible to coyotes because they have great sense of smell, right?
Right, exactly.
We know that from prior shows.
And I know that from hiking up in the foothills with my kids. But, Fred, if a coyote comes near, the bison gather in a tight herd because that is going to help them defend themselves against the coyote has a harder time picking one off.
That's right. And to further make it more difficult, after this bison has injured himself and has blood on him, other bisons go up and rub against him and get blood on themselves. So they all, as a herd, get blood. So it makes it hard to know which is the one that I want to go after because they've all now got the smell of blood on them.
Now that is just phenomenal. God is the most amazing engineer.
Yeah, how about that for an altruistic? God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, right?
Yeah, that's what Paul wrote in Romans chapter 1. And so a bison that gets injured, say it rubbed up against a tree or a boulder, and it cut itself, so it's bleeding. Well, other bison rub up against it, and they spread the blood through the herd so that the coyote doesn't know which is the vulnerable animal, and the whole herd is protected. Fred, evolutionists, this is like a caterpillar liquefying itself and coming out at the other end, a butterfly.
Well, like, how did this evolve?
How does this evolve? Fred, this doesn't make sense that a behavior like this could evolve because it seems, first of all, it'd be self-defeating, right? If there's blood on an animal, then he becomes a target for predators. So the first bison that got the harebrained idea to, when there's bison blood around, go roll in it, is making himself a target for coyotes and other predators, wolves and so on. So that one numbskull would be way more likely to be killed. If there's any survival benefit, then there's also detriments. And so it's hard to imagine, and so that's one problem. So it doesn't really become a benefit until this instinctual behavior is through the herd.
And remember, it has to be some kind of random mistake in the DNA. So is there some mutation that makes a buffalo want to go roll around in blood, and it has to be the blood of another buffalo?
Oh, yeah, right. Like, yeah. So the genome of a bison genome, I don't know how many base pairs it is, hundreds of millions, whatever. Here's my intuitive analysis, Fred. And evolutionists who listen to the show, they love that. Here's my intuitive analysis. It's not a point mutation that creates this behavior.
So it's not a single mutation that causes him to first of all, see blood, process that, and then go decide that by instinct to go roll in it. You're not saying that could happen with one single base pair change,
right?
In what's probably somewhere around four, you know, our human DNA is what? Three to four billion.
3 billion base pairs of amino acids.
You know, buffaloes are probably in the ballpark.
So to have one mutation is not going to produce that. And we have learned, evolutionists themselves have been publishing, when you need a couple mutation, like for fruit fly, in order to accomplish something, you need two. It takes way longer than you ever imagined to get two. Just look at changing a binding site on a protein. Well, anyway, just imagine, Fred, that how many amino acid changes would there need to be coordinated to express themselves in this kind of behavior? So all that, let's say it's 20 or 30, and even that is bizarre because this is a sophisticated behavior that's hard to describe in a biochemical way.
Well, yeah, it's information, it's knowledge that God programmed into the bison.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is information. And Fred, for that then to arise through random changes to the genetic code of a bison, and then all those required mutations have to happen before a single bison could get an advantage. But the single bison that happens to get all those mutations will not get an advantage. He'll get a disadvantage because now he's made himself a target, and it's not going to confer a benefit until the whole herd is doing it. And who knows how long that could take to evolve.
Well, maybe the coyotes take a generation off, and so this buffalo can then interbreed and pass these.
Yeah.
Is he going to pass all 40 mutations on to his offspring? No, there's going to be recombination.
Oh.
And so it's going to get scrambled anyways. I mean, this is not something that makes a lot of genetic sense. In fact, you know, you see the title of these articles, and they throw in the word evolutionary. Gaining value. This is what they're trying to do, Bob. Is they're trying to buffalo us.
Nice one, Fred. So, hey, Fred, could we back to the Creation magazine? The back cover has an article about chimpanzee genetics and their Y chromosome.
Yeah, it's called Y chromosome shock.
Y chromosome shock. The evolutionists were not prepared for what they would find when they sequenced the chimpanzee's Y chromosome. So, Fred, to remind the audience, the gender chromosomes, the sex chromosomes for human beings and other animals are X and Y. Women, to be a woman, you have two X chromosomes. You're a man when you have an X and a Y chromosome. So
only men have a Y chromosome.
Only men. And that's, if you study Y chromosome genes from around the world, you eventually figure out, hey, there was an original human who was, they call him Y chromosomal Adam. But let's not talk about that for starters. They looked at the male chimp's Y chromosome and they were surprised. Why so?
Because they were, to quote them, horrendously different from human Y chromosomes.
A chimp Y chromosome? Now, we're supposed to be closest to chimps.
That's right.
Closer than, say, to a rhinoceros.
Yeah, we were at one point, I think, 99%. Then it was 98, then 94.
Yeah.
I don't know where it's at now, but it keeps getting lower.
I don't know where it's at now, but if you look at just the Y chromosome, not the whole genome of chimpanzees, we're horrendously different.
Horrendously different.
And Fred, when they study Venus and, say, Saturn, do they say, well, Venus and Saturn are horrendously different?
You say they're different. The reason why they're saying this is horrendously different.
That's not a scientific term.
It's to translate that is, this is devastating to my worldview, different between.
Yeah, horrendous. And the one who described it as horrendous is from Cambridge, Massachusetts, David Page of the Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research. And this is in the journal Nature, which is another part of the motherlode of evolutionary dogma. And he's one of the authors of the study, and he describes that there's a third of the human Y chromosome that can't even fit on the chimp chromosome. It's not alignable. And there's a third, actually 30%, of the human Y chromosome that's not alignable to the chimp Y chromosome. And there are other differences, like the chimp Y chromosome has only two-thirds as many genes as the human Y chromosome, and less than half of the protein coding elements as humans. So they're horrendously
different. That's horrendous, Bob.
It's horrendous.
In fact, he said that the relationship between the human and the chimp Y chromosomes has been blown to pieces.
Blown to pieces. And evolutionists, how many times, Fred, do we read these stories where the scientists were shocked?
They were shocked. We over and over again, every show. It's so easy to cover.
Just Google, scientists were shocked. Just Google it. And so it happens, right, over and over and over in astronomy and in biology, microbiology.
Geology, so many different places.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Okay, so, Fred, the Y chromosome difference between humans and chimps is really interesting when you compare it to mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosomal Adam. Those are different stories, but these all relate in debunking Darwinism because mitochondrial Eve is very recent. The evolutionists were shocked. Now, they like to say that she's 200,000 years old, but that's only when they make a circular argument. They say, we know that we evolved from chimps, and so when we look at human mitochondrial DNA, we know it took 200,000 years to evolve from that state.
That's right. They make an assumption at the beginning.
Right, right, they do. And you know what's funny about that? Look at this massive difference on the Y chromosome. That would probably blow that calculation right out of the water. But even at that, they said if they ignore the chimp DNA and they only use the actual human data and human mutation rates and the human difference in our mitochondrial DNA, how long ago did mitochondrial Eve live, Fred? Do you recall?
I do recall. 6,000 years ago.
Six?
That's really a long time ago.
That's according to Ann Gibbons' article in the journal Science, 6,000 years ago. And even the 200,000-year age is a shock to the Darwinist who assumed a mitochondrial Eve would be way further back in time than that. But then you have Y chromosomal Adam, who is also very recent. And Fred, when you add it all up with how recent Y chromosomal Adam, mitochondrial Eve, and the genetic predictions of the story of Noah that we're finding in the X chromosome pattern around the world, three main families of X chromosomes around the world, all but Africa, which is a different part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
It's just awesome to see how science is confirming what never needed to be confirmed, God's word.
That's right. It fits the Bible really well. In fact, Bob, I think you've got an excellent article on this on kgov.com under writings, right? I'd encourage listeners to go there to Why Canaan Was Cursed. It's about halfway down, I'd say, on that page.
Yeah, Why Canaan Was Cursed, right.
And it provides a lot of this scientific information that, again, points to the Bible as accurate once again. The account fits really well with the biblical account.
Yeah, it's really fun. So, Fred, how about pelicans?
Pelicans, okay.
Pelicans are in this Creation magazine, and I think it's on page 9. And they found a pelican fossil. The story, it's like you could write the stories and then just wait for them to come true because they're all the same.
They are. And here's another thing that we say probably about every show is they're commenting about the pelicans.
Yeah.
And they say that what surprised them was it showed just how little pelicans have evolved over huge expanses of time.
Yeah, they find a pelican they say is 30 million years old. And this is the University of Lyon in France. And Fred, these pelicans, you know, they're like 4 feet long or so. And this pelican they found was almost identical to the modern species of pelicans despite its 30 million years.
Yeah, the scientist said he was surprised. So we just had our last article, shock
horrendous.
And awe. And horrendous, surprised. Right. We use these words a lot on our shows.
Yeah.
You know, surprise and shock. Is that kind of like buffalo and bison?
Right. Yeah, right. And Fred, with all the mutations that happen, and even evolutionists talking about the genetic load and how with human beings we have 100 additional mutations every generation. And so pelicans would be having mutations for 30 million years.
That's right.
And that's why the evolutionists say, you know, we're sort of surprised.
And how many times do we have examples of this? You know, bats that are still bats, even though they're supposed to be 100 million years old. This fossil,
dragonflies, still dragonflies.
Still dragonflies.
Yeah.
It's called stasis in the fossil record, and it certainly is not an expectation of evolution, but it is an expectation of the biblical account.
Yeah. And then also cancer is an interesting topic because, Fred, an illustration of the genetic load is that mankind suffering with cancer, that's something that we would expect to see increasing through history, not decreasing, but increase. We're not evolving. We're not getting better. We're getting worse. We're deteriorating genetically. And so when they studied Egyptian mummies for cancer, lo and behold, they had a hard time finding any cancer at all, but they finally found one example.
They did find an example.
They found one example. The first Egyptian mummy diagnosed with cancer has now been documented. This comes out of Nature Reviews Cancer in October 2010. And what's interesting, Fred, is you remember Dr. John Sanford?
Yeah, he was a professor at Cornell University before he retired, and he wrote one of my favorite books on genetics. It's called Genetic Entropy and the Mystery of the Genome. He became a creationist late in his career because of all the overwhelming evidence for intelligent design, and he eventually even came into the young Earth camp. He's fully accepts the Bible, but so he wrote it. You know, he's a geneticist. He's an expert in this field of study.
Right, from Cornell, and he's saying, look, the mystery of the genome, and look at this, the mystery of our declining genes, things are getting really bad. We're getting such a rapid accumulation of harmful mutations that there is no way that Darwinism could survive the reality of genetic reproduction over millions of years. It couldn't do it. And over in Britain, there's a cancer researcher, Philip Bell, who also, Fred, happens to be a creationist, and he is pointing out a specific mutation of apoptosis, where the cell is programmed, cell death is programmed. And so they know now that that's one of the cause of many cancers. The cells are not retiring properly, and they're not dying with dignity, Fred. And so this is so extraordinary that we have creationists who are helping to really understand what's happening in the world around us.
That's right.
Thank you, Fred Williams.
Thank you, Bob.
Another episode of Real Science Friday. Our website is kgov.com. And please help out. We need your help. Thanks.
Is there evidence that God exists? In Bob Enyart's video seminar, Does God Exist?, Bob presents the evidence that God does exist and the evidence that teaches us about God's character. The 2-DVD video set, Does God Exist?, is now available by calling 1-800-8-ENYART and at kgovstore.com. Again, that's kgovstore.com.
This is Bob Enyart inviting you to read our manuscript, The Plot, for an overview of the whole Bible. Call us at 800-836-9278. That's 836-9278.